Timescape, Cassette 6.
After the San Diego Union reporter went away, Gordon still felt confident, though with some effort. The reporter asked a lot of dumb questions, but that was par for the course. Gordon stressed the uncertainties. The Union wanted clear answers to cosmic questions, preferably in one quotable sentence. To Gordon, the important point was how science was done, how answers were always provisional, always awaiting the outcome of future experiments. The Union expected adventure and excitement, and more evidence of a university on its way to greatness. Across this gulf, some information flowed, but not much. He was sorting his mail, putting some into his briefcase for reading in the evening, when Ramsey came by. After a few preliminaries, Ramsey seemed earnestly interested in the weather, he slipped a page from an envelope and said, "This the picture Schriffer showed last night?" Gordon studied it. "Where did you get it?" "From your student Cooper." "And where did he get one?" "Well, he says from Schriffer." "When?" "A few weeks back. Schriffer came to him to check the dots and dashes, he says." Gordon supposed he should have known Schriffer would check it. That was a reasonable precaution. "Okay, it's a small point. What about it?" "Well, I don't think it makes any sense, but then I haven't really had any time to... Look, what I mean is, what's this Schriffer guy doing?" Well, he decoded a second message. He thinks it comes from a star called 99 Hercules that... Yeah, I know. Point is, why is he going on TV? "To figure out that picture. He doesn't know about the first message, the one I'm working on?" "I'm sure he does." "Well, cripes, this stuff on the TV, it's garbage, right?" Gordon shrugged. "I'm an agnostic. I don't know what it means. That's what I just told a reporter." Ramsey looked worried. "Do you think this is the straight scoop, though? The stuff I'm working on is okay?" "It's okay. Schriffer's just an asshole?" "I'm an agnostic," Gordon said, suddenly tired. Everybody was asking him for the eternal, fixed truth, and he had none for sale. "Gee, some of the biochem is starting to make some sense, you know? The little experiment I put one of my students on is panning out some. That's how I know. And this comes along." "Don't worry about it. The Schriffer message may be pure bullshit, for all I know. Look, I've been rushed and..." Gordon wiped his brow. "It's just plain gotten away from me. Keep on with the experiments, okay?" "Yeah, okay. Rushed? Why?" "Schriffer. He thinks he's decoded something, and all of a sudden he's on TV. It wasn't my idea." Oh, yeah. That makes it different." Ramsey seemed mollified. Then his face clouded again. "What about the first message?"
"What about it?"
"You releasing it?"
"No, no plans to."
"Good. Good. You can have all the time to work on it you want." "Fine." Ramsey held out his hand as though a deal had just been concluded. "I'll be in touch."
Gordon shook the hand solemnly. The bit of play-acting with Ramsey had bothered him at first, but he realized it was part of dealing with people. You had to adopt their voice, see things from their point of view if you wanted to communicate at all. Ramsey saw all this as a game, with the first message as privileged information, and Schriffer as simply an interloper. Well, for the purposes of Ramsey's universe, so be it. At one time, when he was younger, Gordon would have been rudely cynical about striking a stance purely to convince someone. Now, matters seemed different. He wasn't lying to Ramsey. He wasn't withholding information. He was merely tailoring the way he described the events. Adolescent cliches about truth and beauty and bird thou never weren't were just crap, simplistic categories. When he had to get something done, you talked the talk. That was the way it was. Ramsey would keep on with the experiments without fretting over unknowables, and with luck, they might find out something. He was walking away from the physics building toward Torrey Pines Road, where his Chevy was parked, when a slight figure raised a hand in salutation. Gordon turned and recognized Maria Geppert Mayer, the only woman in the department. She had suffered a stroke some time before and now appeared seldom, moving ghost-like through the hallways, one side partially impaired, her speech slurred. Her face sagged, and she seemed tired, but in the eyes, Gordon could see a dancing intelligence that let nothing slip by.
"Do you believe your results?" she asked.
Gordon hesitated. Under her penetrating gaze, he felt himself beneath the microscope of history. This woman had come out of Poland, passed through the war years, worked on the separation of uranium isotopes for the Manhattan Project at Columbia, done research with Fermi just before cancer caught him. She had come through all that and more. Her husband, Joe, was a brilliant chemist and held a full professorship at Chicago, while she was denied a faculty position and had to be content with a research associate position. He wondered suddenly if she had been irritated at that while she did the work on the shell model of the nucleus that made her famous. Compared to what she faced, his troubles were nothing. He bit his lip.
"Yes. Yes, I think so. Something is trying to reach us. I don't know what."
She nodded. There was a serene confidence in the way she did it, despite her numb side, that clutched at something in Gordon. He blinked in sunset's lancing light, and the glow turned to warm water in his eyes.
"Good. Good,"
she murmured with a halting tongue, and moved away, still smiling at him. He arrived home just after Penny and found her changing clothes. He dumped his briefcase, carrying the cares of the day, into a corner.
"Where to?" he asked.
"Surf's up."
"Christ, it's getting dark."
"Waves don't know that." He sagged against the wall. Her energy staggered him. This was the facet of California he found hardest, the sheer physicality of it, the momentum.
"Come with me,"
she said, pulling on a French bikini brief and a T-shirt.
"I'll show you how. You can body surf."
He said, not wanting to mention that he had looked forward to a glass of white wine with the evening news. After all, he thought, and suddenly not quite liking the thought, there might be a follow-up on the Schriffer story.
"Come on!"
At Wind and Sea Beach, he watched her carve a path down the slope of a descending wave and wondered at it. A frail girl, mastering a blunt board and harnessing the blind momentum of the ocean, suspended in air as though by some miracle of Newtonian dynamics. It seemed a liquid mystery, and yet he felt he should be unsurprised. It was, after all, classical dynamics. The gang from around the pump house was out in full force, riding their boards as they awaited the perfect oncoming toppling ton of water, brown bodies deft on the white boards. Gordon sweated through the remorseless routine of the Royal Canadian Air Force exercises, assuring himself that this was just as good as the obvious pleasure the surfers took in their splitting of the waves. The required sit-ups and push-ups done, he ran over the swaths of sand, puffing to himself and in a muzzy way trying to unscramble the events of the day. They refused his simple tug. The day would not break down into simple paradigm. He halted, gasping in the salt air, eyebrows dark and beaded with sweat. Penny walked forward on her board, perched in the thick air, and waved to him. Behind her, the ocean cupped itself upright and caught her board in a smooth hand, tilting it forward. She teetered, wobbled, arms fanned the air. She fell. The soapy churn engulfed her. The slick white board tumbled forward, end over end, driven by momentum's grasp. Penny's head appeared, hair plastered like a cap to her head, blinking, teeth white and bared. She laughed. As they dressed, he said, "What's for supper?"
"Whatever you want."
"Artichoke salad, then pheasant, then a brandy trifle."
"I hope you can make all that."
"Okay, what do you want?"
"Well, I'm going out. I'm not hungry."
"Huh?" A dull dawning of surprise. He was hungry.
"I'm going to a meeting."
"What for?"
"A meeting, a rally, I guess."
"For what?" he persisted.
"For Goldwater."
"What?"
"Well, you may have heard of him. He's running for president."
"You're kidding." He stopped, foot in midair, halfway into his jockey shorts. Then, realizing how comical he must look, he stepped in and pulled them up. "He's a simple-minded..."
"Babbitt?"
No, Sinclair Lewis wouldn't have occurred to him. Just leave it at simple-minded. Ever read The Conscience of a Conservative? He has a lot of things to say in there. No, I didn't. But look, when you have Kennedy, with the Test Ban Treaty and some really new ideas in foreign policy, the Alliance for Progress, plus the Bay of Pigs, the Berlin Wall, that pig-eyed little brother of his. Oh, come on, Goldwater is just a pawn of big business. Well, he'll stand up to the communists. Gordon sat down on their bed. You don't believe that stuff, do you? Penny wrinkled her nose, a gesture Gordon knew meant her mind was set. Who sent our men into South Vietnam? What about what happened to Cliff and Bernie? Well, if Goldwater gets in there, there'll be a million Cliffs and Bernies over there. Goldwater will win over there, not just fool around. Penny, the thing to do over there is to cut our losses. Why support a dictator like Diem? Well, all I know is friends of mine are getting killed. And Big Barry will change all that? Sure, I think he's solid. He'll stop socialism in our country. Gordon lay back on the bed, spouting a resigned whoosh of disbelief. Penny, I know you think I'm some sort of New York communist, but I fail to see...
I'm late already. Linda invited me to this cocktail party for Goldwater, and I'm going. You want to go?
Good God, no.
Okay, I'm going.
You're a literature student who's for Goldwater? Come on!
I know I don't fit your stereotypes, but that's your problem, Gordon.
Jesus.
I'll be back in a few hours.
She combed back her hair and checked her pleated skirt and walked out of the bedroom, stiff and energetic. Gordon lay on the bed watching her leave, unable to tell whether she was serious or not. She slammed the front door so hard it rattled, and he decided that she was. It was an unlikely match from the start. They had met at a wine and chips party in a beach cottage on Prospect Street, 100 yards from the La Jolla Art Museum. The first time Gordon went to the museum, he hadn't noticed the sign and assumed it was simply another gallery, somewhat better than most. To call it and the Met both museums seemed a deliberate joke. His first impression was of her assembled order. Neat teeth, scrupulously clear skin, effortless hair. A contrast with the thin, conflicted women of New York he had seen, encountered, a favorite word then, and finally been daunted by. Penny seemed luminous and open, capable of genuinely breezy talk, uncluttered with the delivered opinions of the New York Times or the latest graduate seminar on what is important. In a flowered cocktail dress with a square neckline, the straight lines mitigated by a curving string of pearls, her glowing tan emitted warm, yellow radiations that seeped through him in the wan light. Life from a distant star. He was well into a bottle of some rot-gut red by that time, and probably overestimated the magic of the occasion, but she did seem to loom in the shadowed babble of the room. In better-lit circumstances, they might not have hit it off. This time, though, she was quick and artful, and unlike any woman he had ever met before. Her flat California vowels were a relief from the congested accents of the East, and her sentences rolled out with an easy perfection he found entrancing. Here was the real thing, a naturalness, a womanly fervor, a clarity of vision. And anyway, she had ample athletic thighs that moved under the silky dress as though her whole body were constrained by the cloth, capable of joyful escape. He didn't know much about women, Columbia's notorious deficiency. And as he knocked back more wine and made more conversation, he wondered at himself, at her, at what was happening. It was uncomfortably like a cherished fantasy. When they left together, climbed into a Volkswagen and stuttered away from the still buzzing party, his breath quickened at the implications, which promptly came true. From there, the times spent together, the restaurants mutually enjoyed, the records and books rediscovered seemed inevitable. This was the canonical it. The one thing he had always known about women was that there had to be magic, and now here it was, unannounced, even rather shy. He seized it. And now, in the metaphorical morning after, she had friends named Cliff, and parents in Oakland, and a liking for Goldwater.
All right, he thought. So the details were not perfect. But maybe, in a sense, that was part of the magic, too.
Chapter 17, April 15th, 1963. Gordon had breakfast at Harry's coffee shop on Girard, trying to read over his lecture notes and invent some problems for a homework set. It was difficult to work. The clatter of dishes kept intruding, and a tinny radio played Kingston Trio songs, which he disliked. The only recent item in pop music he could tolerate was Dominique, an odd hit recorded by an angel-voiced Belgian nun. He was not in the mood for concentration on things academic, anyway. The San Diego Union write-up of Saul's PR blitz had been worse than he'd expected, sensational beyond the bounds of reason. Several people in the department had tut-tutted him about it. He mulled this over as he drove up Torrey Pines without reaching any conclusion. He was distracted by a weaving Cadillac with its headlights burning on high. The driver was the typical 40-ish man wearing a pork pie hat and a dazed expression. Back in the late 50s, he remembered, the National Safety Council had made a big thing of that. On one of the national holidays, they publicized the practice of driving with headlights on during the day to remind everyone to drive safely. Somehow the idea caught on with the slow-is-safe drivers, and now, years later, you would still see them meandering through traffic, certain that their slowness bestowed invulnerability. Lights burning uselessly. There was something about such reflex stupidity that never failed to irritate him. Cooper was in the lab already. Showing more industry as his candidacy exam approaches, Gordon thought, but then felt guilty for being cynical. Cooper did seem genuinely more interested now, quite possibly because the whole message Riddle had been elevated out of his thesis. Trying out the new samples? Gordon asked with a friendliness fueled by the residue of guilt.
Yeah, getting nice stuff. Looks to me like the added indium impurities did the trick.
Gordon nodded. He had been developing a method of doping the samples to achieve the right concentration of impurities, and this was the first confirmation that several months of effort were going to pan out. No messages?
No messages, Cooper said with obvious relief.
A voice from the doorway began,
"Say, I was told..."
"Yes?" Gordon said, turning. The man was dressed in droopy slacks and an Eisenhower jacket. He looked to be over 50, and his face was deeply tanned, as though he worked out of doors.
"You Professor Bernstein?"
"Yes?" Gordon was tempted to add one of his father's old jokes. "Yes, I have that honor," but the man's earnest expression told him it wouldn't go over.
I'm Jacob Edwards from San Diego. Now, I've done some work I think you might be interested in."
He turned every sentence into a question. "Well, what kind of work?"
"Well, your experiments and the message and all. Say, is this where you get the signals?"
Yes. Edwards ambled into the laboratory, touching some of the equipment wonderingly.
"Impressive. Real impressive."
He studied some of the new samples laid out on the working counter.
"Hey,"
Cooper said, looking up from the XY recorder.
"Hey, those samples are coated with shit." "Oh, that's okay. My hands were dirty anyway. You fellas got a lot of fine equipment in here. But how you pay for it all?"
"We have a grant from... But look, Mr. Edwards, what can I do for you?"
"Well, I solved your problem, you know. I have, yeah."
Edwards ignored Cooper's glare.
"How, Mr. Edwards?" "The secret," he said, looking secretive, "is magnetism."
"Oh.
Our son's magnetism. That's what they're after?"
"Who?" Gordon began to rummage through his mind for some way to get Edwards away from the equipment.
"The people who are sending you those letters, they're coming here to steal our magnetism. It's all that keeps the Earth going around the sun. Now that's what I've proved."
"Look, I don't think magnetism has anything to do..."
"Your experiment here,"
he patted the large field coil,
"uses magnets, doesn't it?"
Gordon saw no reason to deny that. Before he could say anything, Edwards went on.
"They were drawn to your magnetism, Professor Bernstein. Now, they're exploring for more magnetism, and now that they found yours, they're going to come and get it."
I see.
And they're going to take the sun's magnetism, too.
He waved his hands and stared off at the ceiling as though confronting a vision.
All of it. We'll fall into the sun.
I don't think...
I can prove all this, you know,
the man said calmly in an I'm being perfectly reasonable tone.
I stand before you as the man who has cracked the unified field riddle, you know? Where all the particles come from and where these messages come from. Now, I've done it.
Jesus, Cooper said sourly. Edwards turned on him.
What you mean by that, boy?
Cooper shot back. Tell me, are they coming in flying saucers? Edwards' face clouded.
Who told you that?
Just a guess, Cooper said mildly.
You got something you're not telling the newspapers?
No, Gordon cut in. No, we don't. Edwards poked a finger at Cooper.
Then why'd he say...
Ah!
He froze, looking at Cooper.
You're not going to tell the newspapers, are you?
There is nothing...
Not going to tell about the magnetism at all, are you?
We don't...
Well, you're not keeping it for yourself. The unified magnetism theory is mine. And you educated...
He struggled for the word he wanted, gave up, and went on.
And your universities aren't going to keep me from...
There is no...
From going to the newspapers and telling my side of it. I had some education, too, you know, and...
Where did you study? Cooper said sarcastically. The Close Cover Before Striking Institute?
You...
Edwards seemed suddenly congested with words. So many words he could not get them out one at a time.
You...
Cooper stood up casually, looking muscular and on guard. Come on, fella. Move it.
What? Out. You can't have my ideas.
We don't want them, Gordon said.
Will you see it in the newspapers? Just you wait.
Out, Cooper said.
You won't get a peep at my magnetism motor either. I was going to show you.
Gordon put his hands on his hips and walked toward the man, boxing him in with Cooper on one side and the only escape leading to the laboratory doorway. Edwards backed away, still talking. He glared at them and struggled for a last phrase to hurl, but his imagination failed him. Edwards turned, grumbling, and shouldered his way into the corridor outside. Gordon and Cooper looked at each other. One of the laws of nature, Gordon said, is that half the people have got to be below average.
For a Gaussian distribution.
Yeah, Cooper said.
Sad, though.
He shook his head and smiled. Then he went back to work. Edwards was the first, but not the last. They turned up at a steady rate once the San Diego Union story was picked up by other newspapers. Some drove in from Fresno and Eugene, intent on unraveling the riddle of the messages, each sure he knew the answer before he saw the evidence. Some brought manuscripts they had written on their ideas about the universe in general, or a particular scientific theory. Einstein was a favorite and refuting in the common theme, or, occasionally, on Gordon's experiments. The notion of writing a supposedly learned treatise, using only a vague newspaper article as the sole source, bemused Gordon. Some of the visitors had even published their theses, using the private press's beloved of amateurs. They would present them to him, lovingly handing over bound bundles with lurid covers. Inside, a jumble of terms elbowed each other for room in sentences that led nowhere. Equations appeared by sleight of hand, festooned with new symbols like fresh Christmas tree decorations. The theories, when Gordon took the time to listen, would begin and end in mid-air. They had no connection with anything else known in physics and always violated the first rule of a scientific model. They were uncheckable. Most of the cranks seemed to think constructing a new theory involved only the invention of new terms, along with energy, field, neutrino, and other common terms would appear macron, superon, and flux force. All undefined, all surrounded with the magic aura of the believer.
Gordon came to recognize them easily. They would come to his office or laboratory or call him at home, and within a minute he could tell them from ordinary folk. The cranks always had certain buzzwords that appeared early on. They would claim to have solved everything, to have wrapped up all known problems in one grand synthesis. Unified theory was a dead giveaway. Another was the sudden unexplained appearance of the believer words such as superon. At first, Gordon would laugh when this happened, joshing the crank with a casual manner, sometimes making a joke. But a third hallmark of the crank was his humorlessness. They never laughed, never backed down from their ramparts. Indeed, open display of ridicule would bring out the worst in them. They were uniformly sure that every working scientist was out to steal their ideas. Several warned him that they had already applied for a patent. The fact that you can patent an invention but not an idea had passed them by. At this point, Gordon would try to contrive a graceful exit from the conversation. On the telephone, this was easy. He just hung up. Cranks in person were not so simple. Resistance to their groundbreaking ideas inevitably led to open threats that they would, now here there came the grim look, the reluctant decision that they must use the final, ultimate weapon, go immediately to the newspapers. Somehow, to them, the press was always the judge of things scientific. Since Gordon had been elevated to their attention by the San Diego Union, he would, of course, fear deeply any attack on his position in the same hallowed pages. Finally, Gordon developed defenses. On the telephone, he was quick to hang up, so quick that he cut off his own mother once when he did not recognize her voice and could not make out anything intelligible over the transcontinental static. Crank manuscripts and letters were equally easy. He wrote a note saying that while the person's ideas were interesting, a suitably non-judgmental term, they were beyond his competence, so he was unable to comment on them. This worked. They never replied. On the spot, cranks were the worst. He learned to be abrupt, even rude. This got rid of most of them. The harder persistent sort, such as Edwards, Gordon learned to derail, to gently deflect onto other matters. Then he would edge them toward the door, murmuring reassuring phrases, but never a promise to read a manuscript, attend a lecture, or vouch for a theory. That way lay further involvement and more wasted time. He would edge them toward the door, and they would go, grudgingly sometimes, but they would go. A side effect on this crank traffic came to light in casual remarks from other members of the department. They noted the cranks with interest at first. Amusement followed, and Gordon provided them with anecdotes of strange theories and even stranger behavior. But in time, the mood changed. Other faculty disliked having the department known for its garbled image in the San Diego Union. They stopped asking him, at the afternoon coffee break, what new crank had come by. Gordon noticed the change. Chapter 18, May 24th, 1963. The San Diego area was growing and spreading. Rather than pattern itself on the jumble of Los Angeles, the younger city to the south chose to encourage white-collar employers, clean industries, and think tanks. The largest such tank in the area was General Atomic, scarcely a mile from the fledgling university. Quite considerable fish were to be seen swimming in its waters, puzzling it government-sponsored problems. Noted names from Berkeley and Caltech spent pleasant months scribbling on blackboards, while outside, the General Atomic squirrels and rabbits lazily foraged for their handouts. The animals were part of a psychologist's deliberate plan to evoke rest, quiet, and deep thought. The resemblance to a Disney film may have been accidental. The architect's remorselessly circular motif for the central General Atomic offices, with the eagerly cooperative library at its center, had a similar aim. The ringed roads and buildings recalled Oriental notions of completeness, of serenity, of rest. The curved hallways would increase contact between researchers. In fact, though, the inescapable geometry meant that no one could see further than 30 feet along the curving corridors. This tended to prevent the accidental meetings as scientists came and went. They passed out of view before they could be noticed. To go home or to the library meant moving radially, and thus seeing nobody. As Freeman Dyson said that summer, "The mean interaction distance around here is no bigger than a soccer goal." Yet often, it was enough. These were exciting times. Only 6 months before, Mariner 2 had surveyed Venus close up for the first time. Gell-Mann and others were plumbing new depths in particle theory. In April, J. Robert Oppenheimer was named winner of the Atomic Energy Commission's 1963 Fermi Award. Oppenheimer had been, in the eyes of many scientists, the public whipping boy of the McCarthy era. He had been declared a security risk in 1954. Now, at last, the government seemed to be serving some penance for its stupidity. Hard feelings against Edward Teller, who had not spoken out strongly for Oppenheimer, in turn began to wane. The feeling of opening, of fresh starts, was on the political scene already a cliché. The Kennedy ambiance was a canon of media hype. Vaughn Meader's The First Family album, which mocked the Kennedy clan, sold briskly. The public sensed that the derision was all in good fun. Scientists were a more skeptical lot, however, mostly liberal or radical, and bothered by Bobby Kennedy's generally perceived ruthlessness and neglect of the legal niceties of wiretapping. But the rise of support for scientific research was now coming to seem like a permanent feature, beginning with a sudden rush after Sputnik and rising linearly. Everyone knew it would plateau out, but not soon. There was much to be done, and few to do it. Freeman Dyson came to California on leave from Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study to work on the Orion project. Dyson had an immense reputation as a theoretical physicist and thus was invited to give one of the last spring colloquia in the UCLJ physics department. Gordon was pleased. He was to give the very last colloquium of the year, and to have Dyson speak beforehand about some speculative ideas might diffuse some of the reaction to Gordon. Dyson was slim and humorous, moving gracefully before the blackboard as though in a light trance, thinking hard about what he wanted to say and bending each sentence to strike a precise point. He had been very careful earlier to correct George Fair when he was referred to as Doctor. Dyson had never finished his doctorate and now seemed slightly proud of it, with the Englishman's pride at being, at least in the formal sense, an amateur. But there was nothing amateurish about Dyson's colloquium. His slides were neat, with clear graphics, some in color. They had the professional aerospace finish that to Gordon underlined the pleasant perks of prosperity. In his undergraduate days at Columbia, rough sketches and hand-lettered slides were universal. Dyson described his years of work on Project Orion, the plan to propel huge spacecraft by exploding nuclear bombs behind them. The blast would strike a pusher plate, which would transfer the muted kick through shock absorbers to the ship itself. The idea at first seemed like a Rube Goldberg design, but as Dyson spoke, it became plausible. The only way to ferry truly large payloads around the solar system was through nuclear drives of some kind. Orion was basically simple and used what we were already good at, making efficient bombs. Why not use man's destructive capability for something useful? Dyson thought that a strong effort would not simply put men on the moon by 1970, Kennedy's goal, but beyond, all the way to Mars. The principles involved had been tried in small-scale experiments, and they worked. The problem, of course, was the first stage, lifting the craft from the Earth's surface on a stuttering trail of nuclear blasts. "Won't you plaster us with radioactive debris?" a voice from the colloquium audience called. Dyson pursed his lips. He was a compact man, and his sharp features seemed to pin the problem like a butterfly. "Much less so than the atmospheric tests we in the Soviet Union are now conducting. We calculate Orion would add no more than 1% to the level of radiation that politics," he pronounced the word carefully, "already sets for us." At this point, Dyson became wistful, as though he could sense Orion slipping from him. The newspapers brought daily reports of agreements on the nuclear test ban. Washington rumors said it would be signed within months. If so, even Orion's small dose of radioactives would be ruled out. Toward the end of the hour, after the equations and graphs, there came a bittersweet quality. History would pass Orion by. It might someday fly above the atmosphere, once men had a safe way to get into orbit with chemical rockets. But even then, much of the debris would eventually find its way down into the air. Maybe there was no completely safe way to harness our gift for making bombs. Maybe there were no shortcuts to the planets. The applause which greeted Dyson's somber conclusion was prolonged. He bowed tentatively toward his audience, smiling with sad eyes. Gordon gave the last colloquium of the year. The audience was even larger than Dyson's of the week before, and noisier. Gordon opened with details of the experiment, history of the field, slides of the normal resonance lines. He had compiled all Cooper's conventional results to date and showed how these confirmed the usual theory. It was a satisfactory but relatively unexciting discussion. Gordon had considered leaving matters at that. No reference to the messages, no risks. But something made him cut short the parade of slides. He murmured, "However, there are some unusual features in the noise observed in our work." And he was off, describing the interruptions of Cooper's resonance curves, their suspicion that a pattern lay underneath, then the first decoding. Gordon used the viewgraph projector, sliding the transparent sheets into view as he spoke, his sentences coming quicker now, the words more clipped, a certain momentum coming into his voice. He showed the breakdown of the first message. He discussed the chances that such a message could be a fluke, an accident. From the crowded room there arose a sustained murmur. He described their efforts to track down a local source for the noise, their failure, and then the second message. Gordon made no mention of Saul and the 29x53 grid. He simply displayed the data. The RA18536DEC3029.2 chart filled an entire view graph. Only then did Gordon mention spontaneous resonance, giving Isaac Lakin full credit for the term and the idea. He kept his face blank and his voice flat and calm as he described spontaneous resonance, gave the statistical probability of such an effect arising from random noise, and left the rows of RA18536DEC3029.2 on the view graph as mute testimony. In dry, precise tones, he told of their precautions against outside signals, of the waxing and waning of the spontaneous resonance. Now he used the term archly, pausing before and after the words as if to put verbal quotation marks around them, smiling very slightly. And he paced back and forth before the blackboard, trying to remember the measured way Dyson had done it, head tilted down. The voice came out of the audience. Before the first sentence was finished, heads turned to see the speaker. It was Freeman Dyson. "You realize, I suppose, that Saul Schriffer has made much of this, of 99 Hercules?"
Yes,
Gordon said, stunned. He had not seen Dyson in the crowd.
I did not authorize him to... And that no one at 99 Hercules could possibly be responding to our commercial radio stations yet. It is too far away.
Well, yes.
So if this is a message from there, they must be using communication faster than light?
The auditorium was silent. Yes. Gordon hesitated. Should he back up Saul's idea? Or stand pat? Dyson shook his head.
Now, I spoke last week about a dream. It is good to dream, but be sure to wake up.
A wave of laughter came down from the crowd and broke over Gordon. He stepped backward 2 paces without thinking. Dyson himself looked surprised at the reaction and then smiled down from his position halfway up the bowl-shaped auditorium, his face softening as he looked at Gordon, as though to blunt the edge of his remark. Around Dyson, others were slapping their knees and rocking back and forth in their seats, as though something had unleashed tension in them, and now, with a sign from Dyson, they were sure of how to react.
"I don't propose,"
Gordon began, but was drowned out by the continuing laughter.
I don't...
He noticed Isaac Lakin standing, a few seats from the front and to the left. Eyes in the audience turned from Gordon to Lakin. The laughter died.
I would like to make a statement, Lakin said, voice booming. I invented the idea of spontaneous resonance to explain unusual data. I did so completely honestly. I think there is something happening in these experiments. But this message thing...
He waved a hand in dismissal.
No. No, it is nonsense. I now disclaim any association with it. I do not want my name linked with such claims. Let Bernstein and Schriffer make what they want. I do not cooperate.
Lakin sat down decisively. There was applause. I don't propose to decide what this means, Gordon began. His voice was thin, and it was hard getting the words out. He peered at Dyson. Someone was whispering to Dyson, smiling broadly. Lakin, Gordon noticed, was sitting with arms folded across his chest, glaring down at the RA and DEC. Gordon spun and looked at the coordinates looming above him, large and flat and remorseless.
But I think it's there,
he turned back to the crowd.
I know it sounds funny, but...
The buzzing in the audience kept on. He coughed and could not seem to summon up the booming confidence that Lakin had used. The crowd noise got louder.
Ah, Gordon!
He was surprised to find the department chairman at his elbow. Professor Glyer held up a palm toward the audience and the murmuring died.
We have already run over our allotted time, and another lecture is scheduled to begin here. Further questions can be asked at the coffee to follow, served upstairs in the foyer.
The chairman let a muted ritual applause. It was all but drowned out in a babble of voices as the crowd spilled out of the room. Someone passed near Gordon, saying to his companion,
Well, maybe Cronkite believes it, but...
And the companion laughed. Gordon stood with his back to the blackboard, watching them leave. Nobody came up to ask a question. Around Lakin, a knot of people buzzed. Dyson appeared at Gordon's side.
I'm sorry they took it that way, he said.
I didn't mean it as...
I know, Gordon murmured. I know.
It simply seems so damned unlikely.
Schriffer thinks...
Gordon began, but decided to let the subject alone.
What did you think of the rest of the message? Well, frankly, I don't believe there is a message. It makes no sense.
Gordon nodded.
The press coverage hasn't helped you any, you realize?
Gordon nodded.
Well, some coffee, then?
Dyson bowed goodbye uneasily and moved away with the exiting crowd. The colloquium had trickled away to the coffee and cookies upstairs, and Gordon felt the tension drain out of him, to be replaced by the familiar day-end numbness. As he collected his viewgraphs, his hands shook.
I should get more exercise, he thought. I'm out of shape.
Abruptly, he decided to skip the coffee hour. To hell with them. To hell with the whole damn bunch.
This ends side one of cassette 6. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.